Proud to serve our community for over 50 years, 90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD1, Houston.
COVID-19. Best way to prevent illness is to avoid being exposed. Clean your hands often. Wash your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. Use a hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Avoid touching eyes, nose, and mouth. Wet your hands and apply soap. Lather the backs of your hands between fingers and under nails. Scrub your hands for at least 20 seconds.
I have heard that Bibles have been
Larry
used to
Q.
put the drugs in.
John Ramirez is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Ramirez to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the only state that has carried out executions in 2021. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Linda Huhan Snyder, and special guest Pat McCann, a Houston defense lawyer specializing in Texas appellate and post-conviction remedies. The execution watch for John Ramirez begins.
Hello. We bring you breaking news on this Wednesday, September 8th edition of Execution Watch, the only electronic vigil held whenever the state of Texas executes a prisoner. I'm Marlo Blue. Tonight we stand in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute 37-year-old John Ramirez, condemned in the 2004 murder and robbery of convenience store clerk Pablo Castro in Corpus Christi, Texas. Ramirez's last request to have his pastor, Dana Moore, touch him with a laying on of hands as he dies, a request that has been denied by federal district court and the U.S. Fifth Circuit of Appeals, as both refused to halt the execution. Mr. Ramirez's lawyer, Seth Kretzer, filed an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday. We have not heard regarding that. Execution Watch and Houston Media Source TV obtained an interview with Mr. Ramirez to be aired on this program only if the state of Texas carries out the execution in the second half of this show. Please stay tuned for that. I want to thank our producer, Elizabeth Stein, who has reached out to every prisoner on Texas's death row since this program's inception. Elizabeth has arranged for the interview conducted by our legal analyst, Mr. Larry Douglas, and recorded by our associate and community partners, Houston Media Source TV. These interviews are often the very last records of what the men and women on Texas's death row have to say. We do like to give the public a last look at the person these prisoners have become and why the death penalty may and may not, maybe even life without parole, is not the answer. Joining us in the studio to put this case into perspective are our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas and Mike Gillespie. Larry, this is your second death row interview for Execution Watch. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience?
Well, Marla, as you mentioned, it's my second one. I haven't done this a whole lot.
Right.
And he was an interesting person. I enjoyed the interview with him. He was pretty assertive. He asked me questions while I was trying to interview him. It was also a little bit eerie sitting there talking to somebody who I thought would very likely not be alive for very long. But it was an interesting interview. I went a little bit long, but he was talking.
Well, we're really looking forward to it. And you interviewed him before the results of his last request were handed down. Did he talk about his faith with you at all?
Not specifically about his faith, but I thought it was interesting. I did talk to him about one of the things that he did, that had his lawyer do, is on final argument, just read one psalm and sit down. Now, I thought that was interesting, the psalm being that my sin is ever before me. We talked a little bit about that, but not specifically about the need to have a pastor with him on his final minutes.
All right. Well, for those of you who are new to Execution Watch, this program is the first and only live electronic vigil providing firsthand reports of the Texas death machine in action. We appreciate those of you joining us internationally and on the World Wide Web, and we join those of you who stand in vigil on the streets of Texas cities and beyond. Texas carries out its executions at the Walls Unit in Huntsville, Texas, built in 1849. This is the only Confederate prison still standing and in use. Tonight, we go to our reporter outside of the death house in Huntsville, Linda Snyder. Linda, thank you for joining us.
I wish I didn't have to join y'all this way, though.
Yes.
I do not like executions.
This is the only show we always hope is canceled. It's
yes.
True. Well, can you describe the scene where you are, please?
Well, everybody is very solemn right now. We're just hoping the Supreme Court rules in our favor, but I don't know. They're waiting late to do it. And it's kind of scary, kind of scaring us.
We know that the Ramirez family has contacted the prison show on several occasions. Are any of the family there? Do we know who is
the presenting witness? No, nobody's out here. The witnesses are his wife, and it was supposed to be his godmother, but his two godmothers were supposed to witness, but one of them passed away yesterday.
Oh.
So the other one, that was her sister, so she didn't come. So she's not a witness. So as far as I know, it's just his wife and his half-sister. Named Diamond.
What was the word about John Ramirez from the men on the row?
They all like him. And they all said they've seen such a change in him that he's so much at peace now. I mean, he was an angry man when he first came there, and he was angry up until probably about a year ago. I guess when he got his last execution date, it shook him to the core, and he changed. And all of us love him now. He's just a wonderful man, and he knows where he's going. That's all I can say. He's very at peace. Everybody yesterday when we were there with him were crying, but he wasn't, and he was very, very at peace.
Well, of course, Texas is in the spotlight regarding their refusal to John Ramirez's last request to let his pastor hold on to him as he dies. How are the prisoners
yes.
reacting to that?
They want him to hold on to, they want him to get his pastor to hold on to him because the TDCJ chaplains held the guy's ankle until he took his last breath. But now that they, you know, it's like TDCJ is mad. They're furious, you know, that they lost on that appeal, you know, about letting the pastor in the chamber. But the last one, when they let him in, he couldn't do anything but stand up against the wall and hold the Bible in his right hand and not utter a word. That was the one that I witnessed, so I saw everything that was going on in there. And I asked Barry later, the Salvation Army minister, why didn't he say something, or why wasn't he standing by the bed by John? And they said they wouldn't. He said they won't let me.
Well, Linda, thank you so much. Please let us know when the witnesses cross the road.
I will.
Thank you so much. That was Linda Snyder reporting from Huntsville. Now, Ramirez's attorney likened Texas's most recently revised execution policy to, and I'm going to quote here, a spiritual gag order in court filings. What does that mean?
Well, if you look at Seth's pleadings, I think Seth Kretzer is his lawyer, and he's a fine appellate and post-conviction lawyer. It means essentially that you're trying to deny someone access at probably the most critical juncture in their life to a higher power. And I think that implicates not only the First Amendment, but also due process and simple mercy for that. There's nothing more to do here. In other words, there's no more legal maneuvering. It's time for him to go, and to deny him that, you know, we have the last rights and a minister being in such situations for reasons. Mm-hmm. And they're reasons of mercy, since most of us, at least, you know, those who are not elected governor, don't believe they're God. So when you do that and you deny someone that access, you're essentially saying that that doesn't matter. And I don't think there's a single person that would agree with that.
But didn't the appellate court address that issue well by saying there's too many religions, we can't make accommodations to every religion in the world? I can be a minister. I can open up a church. Does that give me the right to go into chambers and touch somebody when he's being executed? I think the right's important. I think the right to be spiritually touched is important. But I think it's just important to be touched by your wife, your husband, your mother, your father, your child. That is as important as being touched by your minister, especially when your minister is... I got churches in my neighborhood that are basically in shopping centers. I mean, what is a church? What is a minister? It's in your heart and soul. If it's in your heart and soul, you don't need all of this.
That's your belief, though. And that's the problem with imposing that on someone else.
Isn't that what,
make a reasonable effort to get and accommodate the First Amendment right.
Because of that First Amendment right, you can't limit the amount of religions, the amount of people that can do this. They're trying to put, and they just put it back to the state for security purposes. And I do think you're right, the state punished them. I thought the state's recommendations to what they used to do was you had to be on staff was reasonable. I'm not sure it's right, but at least it's reasonable. They were prison employees allowed in. I'm not saying it's right, but
there's no security up there. At that chamber, you are already surrounded by TDCJ employees and corrections officers. There is a group of armed ones outside, and in the chamber itself, you've got a half a dozen corrections officers handpicked and experienced for this. You're inside a locked room. There's no possible security risk at all.
Why can't his wife touch him then? Because I agree with you.
Well, because he didn't ask for his wife.
But if he asked for his wife, would his wife be allowed in there?
No, because that's not a religious amendment. That's not a right to exercise religious freedom.
Okay.
So. And for me, Marlo, at first I was at least somewhat sympathetic to TDCJ's policy, because they, from an administrative standpoint, the concern was opening the floodgates. You know, if you allow the hand touching, then, you know, what someone wants to do the foot washing and the anointing with oil and those kinds of things. But you could all stop that when it happens. But when Linda mentioned that, I didn't know, but Linda mentioned that chaplains used to hold the feet. Okay, now if the holding of the feet was permissible just a couple of years ago, then I cannot see where there's any way to justify denying a dying man the opportunity to have his pastor hold his hand as he goes to his maker. I can't see it.
It just seems so arbitrary.
It's always arbitrary with TDCJ. And the reason it's arbitrary is they get to deny you something. That's their whole purpose in doing almost anything that they do. It's simple denial, so the prisoner's reminded that they don't matter.
The prisoners or the next prisoners in line?
All of them.
Agreed.
All of them. You do this to remind everybody in the system that they don't matter and that the bosses make the rules. That is how TDCJ has functioned for over 150 years. They're all independent baronies run by wardens with no oversight whatsoever. The TDCJ board of directors is a joke. They never suspend or remove a warden unless they're indicted for something.
Wow. Well, how did we get here? Tell us a little bit about what happened. I know nobody wants to really relive what happened, but...
One of the things that bothered me, and I mentioned to everybody, is I spent a lot of time trying to find out about this man, and all I could read about is about the ministers. I think the man has got a place in over here, and what I see is that him and two women committed a robbery and a murder, and so therefore he got the death penalty. But what I couldn't find, who explained to me by Pat and Larry when I got here, what did he do before that and after that to make him continue dangerous society?
Well, just a couple of things. One, the incident occurred back in 2004. The trial was in 2008. In the interim, John Ramirez had gone to Mexico. So they didn't catch him right away. But back on July 19, 2004, John Ramirez and two ladies that he'd been smoking dope with for the last several days were looking for money to continue smoking dope. And they went to a convenience store and killed one of the clerks who was there. They got into a fight and killed him. Both John Ramirez and one of the women he was with were involved in the actual killing. But it didn't stop there. Afterwards, John and the two ladies in two vehicles, then maybe one later on, were involved in an aggravated robbery where John Ramirez is reported to have taken the same serrated edge knife, or knife similar to it, and put it to a woman's throat and took money from her. Okay, now John would caution me. I interviewed him. He says, this is the way the appellate record reads. Okay, I don't know what happened, but the evidence at trial showed this. So I'm speaking as though it happened. Whether it happened this way or not, I don't know. But that's what the appellate record reads. And so John, trust me, that's why I'm saying it this way. He cautioned me on that. And then another attempted aggravated robbery. And then the two ladies got caught and were charged. John was in Mexico, came back 4 years later. And he, during the trial, this evidence was admitted. And John's concern was the sufficiency of the evidence. His claim was that, well, there was one witness who says, I didn't see a knife. But there was enough evidence of a knife. But he did pose his position about sufficiency of the evidence. Now, John was not a shy man. And so he did some controlling of his own trial. In a capital murder case where the evidence is overwhelming, the objective of the defense lawyer is to save the young man's life. And that's really to be done. Normally, you try the whole case, but mitigation is where it's at. Mm-hmm. You've got to show that there is some reason why we as a society should not kill this man. And John tied his lawyer's hands and said, I don't want mitigation evidence. Once John's dad testified, John said, no more. They pulled him to the side and had him evaluated. And the decision was made that he was competent to make the decision not to offer additional mitigating evidence. Tied his hands even further, saying, on final argument, just quote this Bible verse. So that's what happened. And once those things happened, his fate was pretty much sealed. The appellate record is pretty much not particularly eventful because everything happened at trial.
But what about, besides that criminal episode, why is it a capital case? I mean, it makes it, but we see these kind of cases all the time become life in prison cases. Was it because he wasn't there? Was it because, like you said earlier, they had somebody to testify already, quite a deal? But I don't see this being more than just a normal robbery murder. We don't always put that capital. We don't make that always capital.
I think there's two things. One is this was something that was pre life without parole.
Okay.
That was passed in 2006.
That's a big one. Yeah.
So if I were the district attorney and giving credit to the fact that they actually do weigh the danger to the public. I would not want this guy necessarily making parole. And before life without parole, they were still eligible for admittedly a huge amount of time, but that would be one. The second would be because his trial lawyers fought on the robbery issue, the state was able to introduce two other extraneous offenses during guilt-innocence. And without, as Larry said, anything to counter that, all they had to go in was this brutal stabbing and two other crimes he'd done just that night.
So what you're saying is the DA screening of the case, they thought this is a true capital case. And my question is, do you agree with that? This is Corpus Christi. It's not Dallas. It's not Houston. It's Corpus Christi.
I don't know enough about his prior criminal record. If I had been a DA deciding that, and I looked at what he did that night, and he had what I would call significant future dangerousness evidence of past crimes of violence, I might have sought death on that, given that it was before LWOP.
Do we not take into account that he had a bad week, bad weekend?
I know you don't mean that glibly, but no.
I mean it seriously. I mean, yeah. Once you do drugs and you're in a state, you do crazy things.
But sadly, no. Our law is very clear. It's a mitigating circumstance, but not a defense. We don't have a true diminished capacity in the code. We have it in case law under Ruffin v. State, but not in the code.
But we're talking about DA's decision to go for the death penalty or not. And I'm saying at that point of time, should they not look at the total picture or just at the criminal episode?
Well, I'm not trying to defend the DA's position, but I would point this to you. If it had been a situation where it was over drugs, or I was under the or that individual was under the influence of drugs and did something reckless, possibly, but you're looking at what, from the DA's point of view, is a robbery after several other robberies and what appears to be a pretty brutal killing.
Theft case becomes a murder, not a drug deal becomes a murder. I can understand that.
Yep.
I can understand that.
And just a couple of things about John Ramirez. Now, he was a Marine.
Right.
Okay. So, and I commend him for getting through Marine Corps boot camp. Now, he was discharged other than honorably. He was still a very young man, had some minor issues as a juvenile, but no major, no pen trips or anything that like that before this. But this episode was pretty horrendous. But Michael, the issue is always prosecutorial discretion. They can decide, and the way the death penalty statute in Texas is presented, they can decide who lives or dies. And once they make that decision, they can pretty much get it from a jury.
Except that's our job to put pressure on them when they make that decision. That's what we're doing over here. They cannot make these decisions on life and death on people in a vacuum. There's got to be something coming back, and that's what we do over here.
I agree.
We try to give some feedback.
But that's the tough part, as Larry said, is that his client, and apparently in a cogent state of mind, directed him not to do anything, and that's a bizarre place to be.
That explains to me a lot of what happened, and that's what I couldn't find, but that explains a lot of what happens.
And it's why we don't know as much as we would have liked to, you know, about the guy.
And John Ramirez is pretty proud of his ability to decide for himself. You know, I got that from my discussions with him. He was pretty sure that, you know, explaining to me that the evidence was not sufficient to sustain a verdict of guilty on a capital murder case. It was just a murder case. And so once you have a client who's decided that he understands the law, then that makes it difficult for the lawyer to do his job. And I can sympathize with the lawyer who tried the case, because when a client in a capital case does not allow you to put on whatever mitigation he has, I mean, I understand that he was grew up in an abusive home, that his mother had actually stabbed him, and that, you know, just to be able to get through that, it would have been commendable. But he tells his lawyer, after his dad testifies on punishment, don't put on any more witnesses. And then when you handcuff it, tie the lawyer's hands and say, on final argument, read this psalm. You know, that's all I want you to do. The psalm says, you know, what did it say? For I know my transgressions and my sin is always before me. Amen. That's final argument. It's hard to if you're tying the lawyer's hand, the lawyer can't do what the lawyer's tried.
Pat, do you believe that a lawyer at all times needs to listen to the client, which I believe, but if you think your client is doing something which is suicide, at what point of time do you do what you have to do to save his life?
The court decided that. The court had a hearing, had an expert come out, examine him, and said, court, this man is competent to make this decision.
But is that his to make?
That's a problem, though, and this will help answer. Under McCoy now, if the client is adjudged to be competent, then he gets to direct the defense and the direction of the defense. I know that's not how it used to be. Nixon was the old case that said you could make decisions that would disagree with the client's strategy. He wants to argue that he's innocent. You plead him. You say he's guilty of a lesser. You can't do that anymore under McCoy.
Gentlemen, we have not actually heard back from Linda, I believe, but we are under the impression that the execution has already begun. And at this time, is Linda still on the phone? At this time, let's go ahead.
Yes, Linda? I'm here, but why do you think the execution's gone on? Nobody crossed the line.
Are there no witnesses?
There's no witnesses out here, but we haven't seen anyone cross the line.
All right. Thank you. Just keep us informed, please.
Okay.
We were at this point going to go ahead and start the interview so that we can play it in its entirety. It's a little longer than usual. I suppose let's go ahead and do that at this point so that we can get it all in.
Yes. Yes. John Ramirez? No. Who are you? Okay, we're trying to let our audience know.
We've only got 20 minutes, so we ain't gonna be able to get through all that.
Well, we've got 20 minutes.
Right, right.
Just give it to us in a thumbnail. Who are you? Where are you from?
I'm from Corpus Christi, Texas.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Born and raised most of my life. I spent a few years, some of my childhood in Houston, and then ended up going back to Corpus around 7-8 years old, and you know. Your typical childhood, you know, living in the projects, government housing, stuff like that. Where do you want me to start?
Anything that you want to say, the floor is yours. But you know, we're interested in your background, especially if there are any experiences you want to share with the public.
I want to talk about
if there are any experiences that you want to share with the public in terms of how it got you to where you are today.
I want to talk about where I'm at today. I want to talk about death penalty and Texas death row. That's what I want to talk about. You know,
that's
what I mean?
Left up to you.
Right.
Okay. So the Texas death penalty as it applies to John Ramirez.
Well, not just me, as it applies to everybody. You know, it's such a flawed system. It's literally our highest form of premeditated murder that we have in this, in this whole country, I guess you can call it, right? I mean, there's no other institution, there's no criminal that has ever done anything like that where they just hold their victim, you know, against their will and at their mercy for so long, you know what I mean? And under all these oppressive type of, you know, just the way we are here, we're so oppressed, we're segregated, we have to eat crappy food, the mail's horrible, the visitation is horrible, you know, we can't even have contact, as you can see. You know, there's so much here that just needs to be, that I feel needs to be brought to attention. I mean, instead of concentrating on what's going to happen or why we got here, I mean, we got here because we made a mistake, you know what I mean? And if you know anything about my case, because I've done many, many interviews and whatnot and a lot of online stuff, I've never denied that I did kill a man, you know what I mean? What I deny is that I wasn't robbing them because there was no robbery. And the witnesses and my co-defendants, except for the one that eventually took a deal, you know, they attest to that as well. So, I mean, legally, I don't even apply for the death penalty, but, you know, I would like to talk about death penalty. You know, let me ask you, since you're from Execution Watch and you got all this experience, what's your view on the death penalty? What's your stance?
Okay.
You for it? You against it? I mean,
personally, I do not believe that we should, the state should be in the business of taking people's lives.
Right.
I don't even think death is a penalty.
We all have
a date.
Do you understand why? Do you understand why you feel that way?
Do I understand? Because it's wrong.
Right, right.
Okay, you know? It's wrong to take a life.
Right.
But I'm not here to talk about me. I'm here to talk about you.
Yeah,
so
but I mean,
let's just go back to your, you went to the Marine Corps, correct?
Right.
Okay, how was that?
Oh, it was great. I mean, it was awesome. It's the life. I mean, you can't get no better than that, you know?
What do you mean by that?
I mean, good pay, you travel for free. It's such a good life, you know what I mean? I went straight out of high school to the Marines, you know? It just, everything was good. You're exercising, you're in the best shape of your life. There's all types of life experiences, the discipline, the trade that you're learning, the people that you're around, and like I said, you get to travel. I went all over the place, and the pay is great, and if you're living on base, you pretty much don't have to spend much money. You know what I mean? They take care of everything for you, so, I mean, you're just accumulating money while you're serving your country. You know, so, I mean, what else would you like to know about it?
Well, I do want to thank you for your service,
okay?
We need people in the Corps, and you volunteered because it's a volunteer service now.
Well, the reason I did it is because, you know, just being from where I'm from, I was seeing all my friends, they were either getting strung out on dope or they were ended up in prison, or some were even getting killed, you know, and so I was like, yeah, I got to do something. I can't just, I didn't want to go straight back into school, go right into college. Which is the only other choice. My only option was the military. You know what I mean?
Okay, tell me about high school. How'd you like that? You graduated, correct?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I loved high school, too. I mean, everything pretty much from middle school and up was just, you know, party central, you know, just having fun and chasing girls and doing the usual high school and middle school things, you know. You know, when you're young, you ain't got no worries. You ain't got no responsibilities. You ain't got, you know, life isn't, reality ain't hitting you yet, so, you know, it was just fun. It was tough. I mean, of course, we all have our bad moments and whatnot, but I didn't really get in big trouble or anything, even though I was screwing up. I just never really, you know, got caught or got in trouble much, except for little regular PIs and stuff like that. And, you know, I got caught with a gun one time, but, you know, that was because I had just recently been shot, you know, been shot twice in the chest. So, I mean, you know, I was carrying a gun in case I ran into the same guy again. I'd be able to shoot before he shoot me, you know what I mean?
Now, when I was in high school, I was in high school ROTC many, many years ago.
Oh, no, I didn't do none of that.
And there was this guy from the Marine Corps who came around talking to us about going to the Marines. And mm-hmm. He was in the uniform, really impressive.
Right.
And a lot of guys got hooked on that. I started to go myself.
Right.
Okay, but I didn't. Okay, what caused you to go?
Well, like I said, I was either have to go to college or have to do something. I didn't really have a trade or a job back then, so I chose the military. And the way I did it is I was working for the Boys and Girls Club at that time, and I went ahead and had my employer look into all the recruiters and see which one was the best option. And so she brought a bunch of, like, videotapes and pamphlets and whatnot. And you could immediately tell that the Marine Corps was the hardest. Their boot camp is twice as long. Then you got to do another 3 months of combat training, which is extra compared to all the other services. And then you go to MOS school, and you could just tell right away that they had a higher standard. It was way more difficult than all the other branches. So me just being the stubborn little prideful teenager that I was like, yeah, that's the one I want. So that's the whole reason why I chose the Marine Corps. There was no other real reason other than that. Just, you know, pride, I guess.
So you decided to take the challenge.
Yeah, I decided to go for the hard one, you know what I mean?
I mean, see, I backed out. I didn't do that, okay? But you decided because you thought you could do it.
Oh, I knew I could do it. I mean, it wasn't, you know, there's people that I talk to, they pretty much tell you it's, you know, like boot camp and basic training. It's just a mind game, you know? They're just trying to break you down to build you back up. So as long as you can just endure the physical aspect, you're pretty much good to go, you know what I mean?
And you got through that?
Yeah, I got through that. We started off with, like, I think 80-something recruits in my platoon, and we only graduated, like, 34.
Wait a minute, how tall are you?
5'8".
And how much did you weigh coming out of high school?
About 180. 180.
Yeah. That was still pretty big. I mean, I was about 130 coming out of high school myself.
I like 180. I mean, I didn't even, you know, I was just skinny. I didn't really put on much weight. I just got real in shape. That was about it. I came out maybe 205, you know what I mean?
So you really bulked up some?
Yeah, just got more. You know, muscle weighs more than fat or whatever.
Right.
So that was really much it. It wasn't much of a difference. I just, like I said, I just got real fit and sculpted. That's it.
Graduated high school. Mm-hmm. Took the challenge to go to the Marine Corps.
Yep.
Completed it. Boot camp.
Yeah.
And you were a soldier. I was a Marine.
You are a Marine.
I'm told, once a Marine, always a Marine.
Right, that's right.
So you are a Marine.
Right.
Okay. And then after the Marine Corps, what? Tell us about yourself.
Well, I ended up getting in trouble in the Marine Corps, too, when I was stationed in Honolulu, Hawaii, and I got discharged. You know, they basically said I was crazy. They gave me this mental eval that said, I don't know, it diagnosed me like four different things, said I was crazy and discharged me under that. Really, I should have been discharged for other reasons because I was fighting one of my superiors. But, you know, my colonel, I guess he kind of helped me out by giving me a medical discharge because I could rejoin 7 years later. And sure enough, as soon as I got back home, I just got right back into the same old lifestyle, kicking it with the same friends, doing the same thing, getting back into, you know, getting high all the time and drinking and partying. And, you know, I think I got home March 2004, and then in July, I caught this case.
Now, how long were you in the Marine Corps?
Since 02 to 04.
Okay, okay.
02 to 04, yeah.
And where'd you go? You say you're talking about Honolulu, Hawaii. Where else?
California. I went to three different places in California, and then I got stationed in Honolulu, and that was the last place I was at.
Okay, okay, okay.
I requested Japan, but they didn't give it to me. They gave me Hawaii. That was my second choice, so, you know.
Okay. Then you get back home, or did you get a job or anything of that sort?
I don't remember what I was doing when I got back home. Like I said, I was only there a few months. I got back right in the middle of spring break, and so just right back to Party Central, and that was it. By July, I caught this case and went to Mexico, and I was in Mexico for 4 years on the run.
Okay, now what's how did that all happen, going to Mexico for the 4 years?
Well, I woke up the day after the crime was committed, and I saw myself all over the news that they were having a manhunt for me and everything. So I was like, okay, I got to get somewhere, you know what I mean? I'm not going to turn myself in. And so the first thing I did was I fled. I mean, what else was I supposed to do? And I had a friend drive me to Brownsville, and I crossed the border, and there were some other friends over there from the same neighborhood that were already in Mexico wanted for some murders as well. And I just lived with them for a little while until I was able to accumulate some money and start my own little life over there.
Your life in Mexico. So this is 4 years in Mexico. That pretty good life?
Yeah, it was a great life. I mean, everything over there. If I would have known it was like that, I would have went over there a long time ago.
Tell us about it.
I mean, it's just the cost of living is so cheap. The food is awesome. The people are great. You know, the whole criminal aspect over there is just wide open because everything, you know, the police are the cartel members, you know what I mean? They are the members of the cartel. They run everything, so everything's so corrupt. As long as you got someone that you're in with, you got a green light to just do whatever you want over there. There's really no law over there. You just do whatever you want. It's so just wide open. So basically, I never had to worry about getting caught. I never had to worry about getting arrested, getting extradited. I didn't have to worry about any of that. You know, what ended up happening is my very own friends ended up making a deal with the FBI, and then they're the ones that turned me in, you know what I mean?
You thought he was your friend, huh?
Yeah, my very own homeboys, you know what I mean? But they dropped his case, and he was able to go back home. So, you know, I guess it was worth it for him, right?
Tell us about growing up. I mean, tell us about your family and all.
Like I said, I don't want to do the same old song and dance. Yeah, I had a bad childhood, but a lot of people have bad childhoods, and they don't end up on death row, you know what I mean?
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't really want to harp on that and do the pity party thing. That's not really my thing. But, I mean, if you have some specific questions, you can ask me a specific question. What do you want to know?
I'm just opening it up for you, man. Just opening up.
You know, typical childhood, you know, poor, living in the ghetto, living off of food stamps and welfare. You know, just typical childhood. Living in projects most of my life and growing up and having to deal with gangs and all that stuff and violence and fighting and just, you know, just typical poor person childhood. I mean, you hear this story 1,000 times, you know, but like I said, not everyone ends up here. Not everyone ends up killing people. Not everyone ends up, you know, going to the military and then getting kicked out. So, I mean, I don't really want to seem like I'm trying to do that pity party thing, you know.
And I don't want you to talk about anything you don't want to talk
about.
Right. Okay. What I want you to talk about is anything that you think that people might want to hear from you.
Well, I mean, like I said, I want to talk about the death penalty, you know, how crazy this whole institution is. It's just, it's so wild to me, you know, that our own governments are murdering us, and they label it as justice. They dress it up as, you know, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And if they even have any biblical knowledge whatsoever, they know that they're twisting that whole concept, you know, they're twisting it and using it totally wrong, you know.
So the biblical reference to eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth,
yeah,
you're saying?
You notice they never mentioned that that was talking about when animals were accidentally let free and accidentally killed someone. And not only that, when they were talking about a person killing someone, they made a 7 sanctuary cities where they allow you to flee for 7 years. And if you didn't screw up in those 7 years, then you were redeemed. And you can go back into the regular society and live and whatnot, you know. But you don't ever hear them talk about that. Because that doesn't fit their agenda, you know. Most of these politicians don't even know what they're talking about. Not only that, but because this system is so flawed, look at all the people that have been proven innocent once they've already been killed. Look at all the people that have been exonerated once they've been here. It's such a flawed system. If even one innocent person ends up getting killed because of this, then you can't do this. This is a failed system. You can't do this. You have to do something else. Give them life imprisonment. And, you know, looking at it on another stance, like me myself, I consider if I do get killed, I don't want to get killed. I'm not going to help them kill me. I'm not going to help my own government murder me. But if it does happen, you know, it's like a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, I get to get out of here. You know, I get to get free from all this. You know, my struggle is over. All this oppression, it's done. My wages are paid for, you know, like the Bible says. And, you know, at the same time, I don't want to go. And considering like a life sentence, which would be the other option, you got to think, now that's a punishment for them to imprison you for the rest of your natural life. It's just another death sentence, because you're going to die of old age. Now that's a real punishment. If they really wanted to punish us for something, that is a punishment. You have no hope of ever getting out. You're going to live the rest of your days and the rest of your natural life in this type of place, in this oppression, having to deal with all these things that I listed earlier for the rest of your natural life. Now that's a punishment. You know, sitting here for an average of a decade, you know, 10 years, and then being murdered. Yeah, that's pretty harsh, too. But, I mean, that's nothing compared to a life sentence. If you think about it, you know, the reality of it, the timetable, the struggle, the pain, the suffering, just the depression, the sadness. I mean, there's so many aspects that they don't take into account. You know what I mean? And that's not even going back to, like I said, I don't even legally qualify for the death penalty, but yet they're still going to kill me.
Okay, let's talk about that, because it's clear that you've clearly read the law on your case.
Yeah, I've done a lot of studying of the law. You know what I mean? I've helped my lawyers on the last two stays that I've gotten. You know, the last one was a full withdrawal. You know, I hope to help them on this one, too, but it doesn't look too good so far.
Okay. And you're saying that your case should not have been classified as a death penalty case because?
Because it's not. There was no robbery. There was no capital offense, you know, that turned it to a capital. You know what I mean? I've said that from the get-go. And my two co-defendants said the same thing up until 2 years later when they finally accepted a deal. Then they changed their tune and both wrote identical statements, like literally word for word, verbatim, identical. Which, how does that happen? You know what I mean? And the two witnesses, they saw the whole fight, because like I said, it was just a fight where I just went a little way too far. You know, I could just lost it, and I realized I went too far once I saw how badly injured he was. And that's, you know, even the witness will tell you, you know, they were sitting there fighting, and they didn't even know I had a knife. You know, and they're saying that I was punching him. And they say once he fell down his knees, I just stood there and looked at him, and I just stared at him for a while, and I walked away. I walked away, got in the truck, and drove off. You know what I mean? And which is exactly what I said, you know, exactly what I said. I noticed it. That I had cut him in the throat. I noticed that he was bleeding, you know, profusely. I knew he was out of there. Just looking at him, I knew he was out of there. You know, and if you look at the autopsy, I just got fresh out of the Marines. Everything in boot camp, everything in combat training is kill, kill. Everything they teach you, they train you to kill someone in the fastest way possible. One shot, one kill. And if you look at the autopsy, all those wounds, every single one of them was a fatal wound. Except for the 10 that he had on his hands where he kept trying to grab the knife. Those defensive wounds, but all the other ones on his body, every single one of them just by itself would have killed him. You know what I mean? And they don't take none of that into account. I was trained for that. I was fresh out of the military, just being trained all this stuff, practicing this stuff. I was a green belt in MCMAT, Marine Corps Martial Arts. That's a third belt out of five, where they teach us just to kill your opponent in the quickest way possible. One shot, one kill. And none of this gets taken into account in my trial. None of it gets to get brought up. None of this. I mean, it's just they're putting me on a trial where my jury is supposed to be my peers, but none of them are my peers. Not one single one of those 14, counting the two alternates, grew up like I grew up, lived where I lived, did the things I did, you know, experienced things I experienced. So how are they my peers? Not one single one of them is military, you know what I mean? Not one single one of them was Marine or went through all that training. And there's just so many aspects of this whole system that is so flawed and so just screwed up. You know what I mean? And it's, you know, I'd asked you earlier, like, what is your stance on the death penalty? Because I had stopped listening to Execution Watch years ago because y'all had a certain person on there. I can't remember who it was. And I always thought y'all were anti-death penalty, but that guy was like always making weird statements and weird comments where he was like, he wasn't really anti-death penalty. I don't know how to explain it, right? You know, and then like one of the things that y'all say regularly when y'all talk about the case facts and what happened in trial is y'all speak about these things like they're facts. When you're a lawyer, right? You a lawyer?
Yes.
Okay, so you know that in every lawyer that I know, that there's a defense lawyer or even a prosecutor, y'all know that there's so much BS that gets said in the trial. There's so much lie and just blatant falsehoods that get said and get. And I mean, that's the whole thing of a trial. It's litigation. Who can litigate and argue it better? And that you're literally lying. You know that's part of y'all's job. And yet y'all speak about these things like when y'all comment, oh well, he did. Excuse me. He did this or he did that, as if that is a pure fact. Y'all don't even entertain that maybe that might be wrong, or maybe they're just saying that, and the defendant, you know, whoever it is at that time, like being me in this case, just wasn't allowed to speak. I tried speaking in my trial, and I got shut off by the judge. He told me if I spoke again that he was going to kick me out and have me view the whole trial through a monitor because I tried to speak up, because my lawyers wouldn't speak. My lawyers wouldn't say what I want them to say and do what I want them to do. You know, that's why, if you know anything about my trial, when we got to the punishment phase, that's why after they put my dad up there and they just basically trashed him. Even though I don't even like my dad. I didn't even grow up my dad. There's no love lost between me and him. But they're not going to put my family up there and just smash him and play the pity party and try to get all that sympathy vote when they're not even doing their job like I asked them to do. You know what I mean? So that's why I made the decision to not put no mitigation evidence. Not because I was trying to get the death penalty, or I was trying to get killed, or I was on some type of weird suicidal, you know, thing. No, it was nothing like that. But like I said, this is all things that y'all don't know about, you know, and that y'all don't ever speak on when y'all do the show. That's why it was one of the first things I asked you, what's your stance on it? Because, you know, those are things that are very important to this whole show, to this whole issue of being on death row and being in the death penalty. And, you know, I don't ever hear nobody talk about that. I always hear people talk about their background and whatnot, and that's fine, but you can find all that on the internet. You can find all that in our case. You know, I want to talk about the death penalty. That's why I was like, you know, that's why I started the conversation with that. Because this place is so screwed up, man. This place is so messed up. This whole institution is just, it's a big joke. And the end of this joke is they're murdering people, you know what I mean? And it's just crazy to me. I mean, like you said yourself, it's wrong. It's wrong. And I don't know. I mean, if I could speak out against it, I get like this avenue here where I can talk. And if I end up getting murdered too, and then y'all get to play it, I mean, hopefully I'll say something that will help someone, you know, take action or stand up, do something. You know.
How old are you now?
I'm 36.
36. So you could conceivably live several more decades.
I'm perfectly healthy. I mean, I'm a little on the chunky side, but other than that, I mean, I'm perfectly healthy. Other than being executed by lethal injection, I'll probably live a long, long life, even in prison, you know what I mean?
And you would prefer that?
Like I said, it's like a double-edged sword. Yes and no. I mean, like I said, it's just another death penalty. You know, I'm kind of, I can see both ends of it because I've thought about it so much, so... I'm not going to help my government murder me.
Okay.
So, automatically, then yes, if they gave me the option, then yeah, I would take it. But at the same time, I don't want to live the rest of my life in prison. I will, if that's the only option, you know what I mean? I will. I get to see my son's, boy. He's 15 now, you know? I got arrested when he was 2 years old. He's bigger than me. He's a big old monster, you know? I used to call him my mini-me. Now I'm calling him my mini-Shrek because he's so big, you know what I mean? I don't know what they're feeding him. But I would love to see him grow into a man. I would love to see his first, like, serious relationship. I would love to become a granddad, you know, and see my grandchildren and whatnot. You know, it's just, you know, Texas just doesn't want to let me do that, you know what I mean? And And it's so crazy because I'm one of the few people that actually, you know, has taken responsibility for the crime. I mean, of course, after they captured me, of course I ran. I mean, who's not going to run something like that? You know what I mean? But I'm one of the few people that actually take responsibility for the death that was caused by my hand, and it's not getting me nothing. You know what I mean? I don't get no credit. I don't get nothing for that. I might as well sit here and do like everyone else and just completely deny it. You know what I mean?
You were giving us a little advice earlier about what we should be doing on the show, mm-hmm. in terms of, tell me what you would advise us to do.
I'm basically talking about the way y'all speak about the case facts. When y'all start talking about the cases, you know, y'all start to show up, and y'all start talking, okay, Texas is going to have its way, blah, 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 and y'all start talking about the cases. Oh, Ramirez, he was whatever, for robberies and murder and this and this and that. He was robbing Pablo Castro and blah, blah. You know, y'all say things in such a way, like from my point of view, and I know other people feel the same way because other people have said the same things about Execution Watch. And especially when that old guy used to be there. He's not there no more. I don't know who he is. I don't remember his name or whatever. But he would always be real outspoken. He would always say things that were real, like, demeaning and damning toward the person that y'all are doing the show about. You know what I mean? And Ward, what was that guy's word? Adam Ward, I believe. Man, he, like, outright just downed the dude's family and talked about the dude's family was dirty and they had a house that was all, and they were hoarders. And it's like, that's not necessary. I mean, the show's not about that. The show's about the death penalty and what the state is doing. And, you know, if you wanted my advice, I would say talk about the death penalty. The death penalty is wrong. You know what I mean? They're about to just murder this man. You know what I mean? Like, every time I talk about it, I use the word murder. I don't use the word execution. I use the word murder, you know, because that's what they're doing. They're murdering you. You know, this is the definition of murder, and it's the highest form of premeditated murder that you're going to find in this whole country. You know what I mean? You know, there's so many aspects of this death penalty that is so wrong that they can open people's minds to a different train of thought. Like, if you're going to take my biggest mistake, which is taking someone's life, and hold me to that one mistake, say, this is who I am. You know, you said your name is, what was your name?
My name is Larry Douglas.
Larry Douglas. Okay, what? Think of the worst thing you've ever did in your life. Now, imagine if everybody, your whole society, your family, and everybody treated you according to that mistake for the rest of your natural life. That's not right. I mean, if you're going to do that, why don't you pick my greatest accomplishment? You know what I mean? I created a life too. Why don't you pick that and judge me on that and hold me to that standard for the rest of my life? No, you want to pick the worst thing that I have done. You know what I mean? I read a quote by, Ezra Pound, where he says, there's no reason why a man should like the same book at the age of 18 that he would like at the age of 48. Was exactly. I'm not the same person I was when I did take that life. And I can tell you myself, I was pretty screwed up. You know, I was pretty selfish. I was a terrible person. Really, I really was. I didn't care about nobody. I mean, that's the only reason why something like that could happen, where I could just stab a person that many times so carelessly and not even think about what could possibly happen. He could possibly die. I can be so drugged up on pills and alcohol and weed and cocaine and, you know what I mean, and not really care about how I'm affecting those around me. I know that. I see that. But I'm a totally different person now. You know what I mean? The person that they're going to execute on September 8th, if it goes down, that's not the same person that committed that crime. You know what I mean? So, there's just so much. There's so much content here.
Okay. We're about done now. We've run just about out of time. But you give good advice. And so, as we close, I was just wondering, you know, at your age right now, if you had to give some advice to the 15... 20-year-old John Ramirez, what would that advice be?
I don't know. Read a book. Learn, you know, educate yourself. You know what I mean? I've done a lot of educating since I've been in here, you know, a lot of just expanding my knowledge and my mind, and just, you know, I just know a lot more than I did back then. I think that's the reason I was just so messed up back then. I was just so ignorant.
And is there anything else you'd like to say before we...
You know, anyone that's listening that doesn't advocate or that could advocate or has a venue, has a you know, an outlet, you know, just keep fighting this. You know, it's eventually they're going to do away with this, eventually. But, I mean, the more people that fight it, the faster it'll be gone, you know.
I think you're right about that. Eventually
it'll
be...
Yeah, eventually, it's, you know, everything changes. Everything changes, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's a cycle of life. So eventually they're going to do away with this, you know, especially as more and more states do away with it. Eventually, Texas is going to have to, you know, get in line, too.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it always helps. The more voices we have, you know, make some noise. Don't be afraid to be heard.
We appreciate your voice.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care now.
All right.
Bye.
That was the final interview with Mr. John Ramirez, heard here in its entirety, unedited and uncut. This is going to be archived on the Execution Watch and Houston Media Source websites as a final message from the man who we are still waiting to hear what's happened to John Ramirez in Huntsville, Texas. We apologize if there is any miscommunication. We know that with the passing, the execution of Quentin Jones in May of this year, the Department of Corrections has a new policy of not necessarily letting us know what is happening in the death chamber in Huntsville. Larry, thank you very much for that interview. It was very, very deep and important, and we appreciate you taking the time to do this. I'd like to give a shout out, if possible, immediately to John Ramirez's mother, who has been calling in to the KPFT prison show, and there is a final shout out that she's going to be giving coming up this Friday night, 8:30, KPFT 90.1 FM. Well, it is time for us to wrap up Execution Watch for today, and please join us on September 28th when Texas plans to usher Rick Rhodes into the death chamber in Huntsville, Texas. If it does, Execution Watch will cover the state-sanctioned killing live. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, you can find us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org, where you can also get it on our mailing list for all the latest updates. Thank you to our guest, Pat McCann.
Pleasure to be here.
Our panel, Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our Death House reporter, Linda Snyder. Our executive producer, Elizabeth Stein. KPFT and Pacifica executive producer and technical advisor, Otis McClay. And Dakota Sampson, who's new to our team. Houston Media Source technical producer, Mark Pirtle. And for those listening live on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, please stay tuned for the second hour of Tierney Malone's Houston Jazz Spotlight. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.
Hey everybody, Juan Flores inviting you to listen in to Jazz Latino right here on KPFT every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Join Lupita and me for some great Afro-Cuban Latin jazz right here on Houston's Community Station.
Good evening, Houston. This is your forecast for KPFT. For tonight, isolated showers, mostly clear with a low around 74. For your Thursday, it will be sunny with a high near 95. And for your Thursday night, clear with a low around 70.